Okay, here we are again. All right. Well, we're going to talk about karma, isn't it? Karma, does it say karma on the list? What does it say? Causes of happiness. Okay. Okay. So why are we going to do this? Hey, baby, because we want it. It's very reasonable. And we don't want the opposite, which is suffering. So we're going to listen to Buddha's take on this, his view, his observations from his own experience. He did not make this up. He is not a creator. If he is speculating, it's very naughty. So we have to assume it's from his own direct experience. He's a knowledge holder. The word Tenzin, His Holiness the Dalai Lama's name, knowledge holder, a person who's got the experience of something. So we're going to listen to the Buddhist teachings through this Australian mouth. Hopefully everything I'm saying is authentic. It's my responsibility to be authentic, not to make up something and add some Rabinaism into the Buddhism. That would be very naughty. And we're going to listen, so we want tools to help us stop suffering and get happiness, and then to help others do the same job. This is why we're sitting here. So in that sense, we're the boss. We're listening to see if there's something we can use, we can choose to use in our life. We are the boss. And I want to just do something else to start. Just read a little. Where's Sarah? Okay, all right. It doesn't matter. So you guys don't have. Okay, I'll ask her later. Where's Sarah? Sarah can come in. Sarah. Calling Sarah. Come here. Do you guys have the practice of Lama Zobram Shesa's latest one called Daily Practice?
Yes, I do.
You don't have it for the center?
Yeah,
you don't have it for the center, I'm asking.
No.
It's okay. So then, okay, I'm going to read this little prayer, like the short Lam Rim prayer that Rinpoche starts with, the first one in this thing. And maybe it's nice that you, have it for people if they want to see it, have it available, because Rinpoche puts it out, it's free, and maybe people might choose to do some aspects of it. They might. But to have it available, even as a PDF they can download. Do you have that on your website, where they can download PDFs? Yeah, well, this is a really nice little practice. Rinpoche keeps coming up every day with different daily practices. He begins with a whole millions of pages, and he gets it down real short, because he knows we don't like long things, you know? So this is something, it's just a little Lam Rim prayer. It's very holy, but it's got all the points of the path in it. And so for those of you who are Buddhist, it'll be nice to hear. And for those of you who aren't, it's okay. You just don't have to listen if you don't want. Okay, that was all. Thank you. You may go and do your jobs. Okay, I'll read it out as a beginning of the practice, just to put all the points of the stages of the path to enlightenment into our mind. Very short. On Rinpoche's translation, he's got his own way of talking English. He likes his own style of talking English. So essence encompassing all the Buddhas, originator of all the holy Dharma of scriptures and realizations, all the words and the realizations in the mind, principle of all these Aryas intending virtue, to the glorified holy Guru I go for refuge. Please, Guru, bless my mind to go in Dharma, Dharma to go in the path, and to not have obstacles to the path. Please bless me until enlightenment is achieved, like the youthful Norsang and the Bodhisattva always crying one. This always crying person, he's famous for every time he heard of thought of sentient beings, he'd burst into tears with compassion. He's a Bodhisattva always crying one. To devote to the virtuous friend with pure thought and action, whatever is done, see it as pure, and be able to accomplish whatever is said and advised. Please bless me by seeing this body of freedom and richness, this human body we worked so hard to get, which has great meaning, is difficult to find again and is easy to perish, an action and result, karma, so profound. So difficult to bear the suffering of the evil migrators, to sincerely from the heart go for refuge to the three rare sublime ones, abandon negative karma and accomplish the practice of virtue according to the Dharma. This is the graduated path of the lower capable being. This is junior school. Now, depending on that, even though one has achieved the mere higher rebirth of a deva or human, because of being under the control of not having abandoned the disturbing thought obscurations or the delusions, one needs to experience suffering endlessly in the samsara. So please bless me by thinking well about the way of cyclic in samsara, to be able to follow day and night continuously the principal method liberating from that, the three precious paths of training. We'll talk about this. This is the graduated path of the middle capable being. Well, I like to call that high school. But depending on that, Even I achieve the mere liberation, because there's no sentient being of the six types who has not been my father and mother. Please bless me to fulfill their purpose. Please bless me by thinking like this, to change the mind from the lower happiness, nirvana, and generate the precious thought of enlightenment, bodhicitta, through equalizing and exchanging myself and others to be able to follow the conduct of the victorious sons, the bodhisattvas, the six perfections, and so forth. This is the graduated path of the great capable being. University, I like to call that one. So by having trained the mind in the common path like this, I will have no upsetness. It's a new word for Rinpoche in the dictionary. No upsetness. And why not? We make up words every day. In experiencing the sufferings of samsara for a long time, and by seeing it as unbearable, especially with compassion towards the sentient beings, entering the quick path, the teachings of the Vajrayana, and protecting my commitments and my vows more than this life, please bless me to be able to accomplish quickly the unified Vajradhara state in one brief lifetime only of this degenerate time. And this is the graduated path of the secret mantra Vajrayana vehicle of the greatest capable being. Okay, so now let's look at what the causes of happiness are. But it seems to me the first thing we have to do to understand that is how we define happiness. We could all have different views. Everybody in this room would have a different view of what happiness is. And so it's like saying how to make a chocolate cake. If you don't know what a chocolate cake is, you've got to learn first what it means, and then you can have to learn the methods. What are the causes of a chocolate cake? So what is happiness? And this already implies so much in the Buddhist view. And by understanding what happiness is, we can then understand what suffering is. And once we understand the causes of happiness, we can easily understand the causes of suffering. And then we know what to do to get happiness and what to not do to not get suffering. It's quite logical, you know. So what is happiness? What is happiness? Well, the first very simple point for the Buddhist approach is that what happiness is where it exists, is in the mind. Don't hear that like the way we say it in the West, oh, it's all in the mind, meaning it's really meaningless. We actually mean that. Oh, it's all in the mind, meaning it's got no meaning. But happiness is a characteristic of pleasure or joy or fulfillment or contentment, whatever you want to call it, depending on the degree, that exists in your mind. It does not exist in your brain. It does not exist in your nose or your eyelashes or your feet. It does not exist in a cake or a person. It does not exist in anything other than your mind. This is something really simple to get first. It's a quality of your mind. It's a feeling of pleasure. The word pleasure or pleasant or joy or all these words are variations of happiness. Suffering, exactly the same. It's a quality. It's an unpleasant feeling. The correct words in Buddhism for happiness would be a pleasant feeling. And the word feeling is very specific in Buddhist psychology. It doesn't mean like an emotion the way we think of it. There's only three kinds of feelings we could ever have, according to this model of the mind. There's a pleasant feeling, which is called happiness. There's an unpleasant feeling, which is called suffering. And then there's lots of feelings that are neither of those that you could call neutral or indifferent. There's lots of those, neutral. So we forget those, don't you worry. The ones of pleasant and unpleasant are absolutely central to understand if you want to study Buddhism and understand Buddhism and practice it. You've got to know what he means by it. We use these words so powerfully and it's so instant. The millisecond anyone hears the word happiness, they say, yep, I want that. But everyone would interpret it differently, translate it differently, see the causes differently. We know that. So if we want to understand what Buddha's approach is, because this is a big deal for him. So difficult drinking my water, isn't it? I have to do this. I'm sorry. Hang on. Then we have to understand what he means by it. So the simplest way to put it, technically, is it's a pleasant feeling. A pleasant feeling. A pleasant feeling. And feelings exist in the mind. It's a quality. It's a mental state. It's a mental state. So obviously we can see if we look at one day of our life, if we were really excellent in our ability to internalize and see what's going on inside here, we could track our day. You know, if you track your day externally, you'd go, well, you have your little kind of throughout the day. 8 o'clock, we had breakfast and had breakfast, and 9 o'clock drove to work, and 9:10 hit the car in front of me, and 9:30, you know, you understand, you track each day, you track your day in terms of the external events, and this is how we do it. We do this. How'd you go today? Oh, really good. Nice food, good boss, pleasant weather, good red lights, ugly this, whatever it might be. We track everything externally. Think about it. We define things internally, but it's external. The person says, oh, what happened at 10 o'clock? Oh, wow, Mary smiled at me. What happened at 11 o'clock? Oh, Fred was mean to me. We see it all external. Everything's external, which is fine because they're all happening. They are. The world is an external place. There's things going on. We can track those external things. But that's all we do. Now, the way we think about it, we think that I'm this person kind of plodding through this minefield called life, all these external events like an obstacle course, and I'm this innocent victim who kind of got plonked into this external environment. I didn't ask to get born, did I? I got plonked into this world, and I'm this kind of, I'm an observer and a recipient of things, and then I'm, and then when something out there that I call nice, then that makes me feel good. Then when something ugly out there happens, that makes me feel bad. This is the logic we instinctively believe in and we act out every single day. The real world is out there. I'm this empty kind of nothing person that got plonked into the middle of it. And so, you know, empty and dissatisfied. So then I have to constantly look for the nice things and you know, ingest them through whichever sense is most convenient. And then live in fear of the ugly things and push them away when they come. It's a way of talking about how we live our lives. And all the beings do this. Look at dogs, look at ants, they're doing the same thing. So why we're doing this is because we utterly believe in the bones of our being without being told as an absolute definite scientific truth, and the whole world upholds this because we're all in the same boat, that nice things out there are the cause of happiness, so that's why I must get them, and that's what brings attachment. The craving for those things because I'm desperate for a good feeling. So, okay, we know we have good feelings. We know it's in here, the feeling. But we believe it comes from there. We believe it comes from there. Absolute certainty. And that's what everyone's life is about. Desperately trying to find the things out there that such that when I get them, it'll trigger a good feeling. So that's why we believe good people are the cause of happiness. Beautiful houses are the cause of happiness. Lovely food, nice weather are the causes of happiness. Very simple. That's our materialist philosophical view. Not even materialist. That's the samsaric philosophical view, Buddha would say. And therefore, because we have the craving to have nice feelings, no one has to teach us that. And then when we see a certain thing and it triggers a nice feeling, we deduce logically that's the cause, so we grasp after it. And then we see the ugly things that come along that trigger a bad feeling, like big surprise. Oh, wow. So we absolutely have aversion for those. We walk away from those. The uglier they are, the more violent the unhappy feeling, the unpleasant feeling, and the more distressed we become. This is how we live our lives, is it not? It's a simple way of talking about how we live our lives. And this is the philosophy of the world, and we don't question it for a millisecond. This is the truth as far as we're concerned. And our scientific world reinforces this. Reinforces this as true. All Buddha's saying is, you're mistaken. It's not the correct assessment of reality. It's mistaken. He's not being moralistic. He's not saying we're naughty and you shouldn't be this way, which is how we think about it in a kind of childish religious way. Oh, I shouldn't like chocolate cakes. That'd be ridiculous. Of course you can like a chocolate cake. All Buddha's saying is, we're addicted to this method of understanding happiness and it's deeply internalized. And it's instinctive now, but he's saying you've got it wrong. It's like you've got the wrong recipe. You haven't got the right recipe. You've just got it wrong. And we wonder why we don't get the happiness when we get the cake, get the Fred, get the this, get the that. We get it for a while, and then it disappears again. So we don't question this. We just assume this is all there is. So then if we tracked our days internally, you track the feelings. So you know very well in the day. First you track the external, you know, you looked at your diary, you know, red light, ugly grandma, beautiful husband, nice children, medium weather, delicious food, freezing this. You could know, oh yeah, that triggered a pleasant feeling, unpleasant, pleasant, very pleasant, very pleasant, very pleasant, very pleasant, miserable, horrible, horrible, neutral, neutral. You'd track it this way, wouldn't you? You'd have either pleasant, forget the neutrals, you'd have pleasant and unpleasant feelings. You'd have moments and periods of pleasant and unpleasant feelings. That we know, perfectly reasonable. So let's look at Buddha's explanation of how those of the causes of those pleasant feelings and the causes of those unpleasant feelings. It's not complicated. It's not complicated. It's just that we're so addicted to seeing it in another way, we can't hear his view. It's not complicated. So first of all, happiness is a pleasant feeling. So a day of happiness is a day of many moments of pleasant feelings. And the Buddhists, they would talk in Buddhist philosophy and Buddhist psychology, there are 64 moments in a finger snap. That's how they measure moments. They're not very technical about that. Like one of your stopwatches, you know? How many milliseconds there are in a second these days when you win the Olympic medal by a hundredth of a second? 64 moments in a finger snap. So there's many moments is either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral feeling throughout a day, necessarily, any sentient being. It's just the way it is. So we know we have pleasant feelings. We know it's here somewhere. And we know we want them. And we know we have unpleasant feelings, and we do not want them. But the logic we use is completely mistaken, Buddha says. And the tragedy of the logic we use is that by believing happiness comes from out there and grasping after it, we're actually increasing the suffering. We're increasing it. And by believing the suffering comes from out there, and by blaming and getting angry, we're increasing the suffering. We're actually digging ourselves deeper into samsara. And the word samsara for the Buddha is not some weird place, you know. It's the name given, if you like, to living in these misconceptions. Buddha would call them misconceptions. He'd call them mistaken conceptions. Simple thing. He just says we've got it wrong. So if it's so simple as that, or I haven't got to the cause, his view yet, what the cause is, but if it is as simple as that, that we've made a mistake in our assessment, we're going to go into what he says, then we have to, we should wonder why it's so hard to see it. And the only reason, the simple reason, is because we're addicted to it. And why are we addicted to it? Well, this gets us to the bigger picture in Buddhism, which is this business of your consciousness being not physical, your consciousness not coming from your mummy or daddy or coming from a creator, and not beginning at the time of rebirth, not the beginning at the time of conception, which is, again, another view we all live with, a view we believe is a scientific truth. Buddha, again, disagrees with this one. He's got a very different observation about things. He would say that you didn't begin, you know. Your body and your body began. Yep, of course it did. Mummy and daddy's egg and sperm, that is easy to prove. Egg and sperm is what began your body, you know. And then it began to multiply when your mummy ate food and all the business happened in her body. Your body grew into this body. That's clear. So your body came from your parents. Very kind. But the Buddha would say your mind didn't. So to even begin to understand this business of what is happiness and what is suffering, we have to be clear what he means by what is the mind, because happiness and suffering are moments of pleasure or unpleasure in the mind. In the mind. So what's the mind for the Buddha? This is fundamental to get clear. And not to believe in it, but to take it as your hypothesis. If you want to understand the Buddha's methodology, you've got to understand what he's saying. That means you've got to take it on board as at least an idea. Just like you were learning acupuncture for the first time. You've never heard of a meridian. Who's heard of a meridian, for God's sake? You can't even see a meridian. But you take it on board as a concept. You do, otherwise you won't learn it. You have to do this, to take it on board as a hypothesis, and then you learn the theories. Same here, same here, same here. So happiness and suffering are moments. You can divide them down into moments of pleasure and unpleasure, pleasant and unpleasant feelings in your mind. So, your mind is not your body, but nevertheless, they have this intimate, inextricable, interdependent relationship, and that's pretty obvious. So until quite recently, in our materialist world, we believed you're stuck with the brain you're born with, and it's only now, as a result of all these amazing experiments on the minds of meditators and these incredible discussions between these, like say the Dalai Lama and all of those scholars and holy beings and the greatest, you know, the great scholars in the West and all the neuroscientists talking and looking and experimenting, we are now discovering in the West that you're not stuck with the brain you're born with. That by the very way you simply think, nothing holy, but just by changing the way you think, you can reconfigure your brain. Whereas we would always utterly believe before the brain is the boss and it determines how we think and how we feel, that we're victims of our brain. So even now it's amazing to see that in our culture we're saying, you know, neuroplasticity, that you can change your brain. Not with a knife, not with surgery, but by changing how you think. So it's kind of interesting. And of course this is the Buddha's point. The mind is the boss. So you've got your, so anyway, the difference, the added point, the Buddhism would say the thinking process and your feeling process, your pleasant and unpleasant, this is a function of your mind, not your body. Your mind, not your body. Your mind, which is your consciousness, your mind. And this is a word used to refer to all your feelings, all your emotions, all the unconscious, all your intellect, all the instinct, all the intuition, the whole part of your inner being that is not your body. That's your mind. And so, of course, the job of being a Buddhist, finally, because we want to have pleasant feelings and don't want unpleasant ones, and because they're a function of your mind, we'd better be clear what the mind is and learn to get to know how to see it, hear it, identify it, and change it. So we can create the causes of happiness and stop creating the causes of suffering in our mind. So your mind is not physical. Your mind, think of it as always they talk about it. You know, think of it as a river of mental moments. You can't touch it, you can't smell it, you can't see it. It's a very subjectively used word in Buddhist philosophy and psychology. We think of it as this brain up here that has all these things happening. You know, you can observe it with a microscope. Not in the Buddhist view. Like I say, you know, joke. You ask a great Tibetan meditator, a person who's really involved in knowing their mind and changing it radically in the way Buddha talks, ask them where their brain is and they will never have heard that word. They do not know. They don't need to learn the brain to know your mind. You can learn to know the brain. We do it brilliantly in the West. It can help us a lot. Because it's an indicator of things. It's a sign of things. But it's not the thing itself, the way Buddha would put it. So that's what, so it's a very internal, introspective job that has to be done to know your mind. Learning to use the focusing meditation so you can steady the mind down and then begin to hear more clearly. What at the moment for us is just this ocean of weird feelings. We don't even seem to be articulate until they're very strong. This is a super difficult job to do, but this is the absolutely central job of a Buddhist. So, your mind being not physical, we'll take that on board as the idea here. So to think of it as a continuity of mental moments. And if you had perfect memory, you would track it back to the first second of conception. And you track it back in this linear sense. Of, well, if this moment of my mind does exist, for sure, I'm thinking and feeling this moment. What's the main cause of this moment of my non-physical thoughts and feelings? Well, it has to be something of the same character. A previous moment of my non-physical thoughts and feelings, my mind. And then what's the cause of that? The previous moment. What's the cause of that? The previous moment. Like this chain of mental moments, and you know you'll find an unbroken chain, unbroken. There won't be sort of a piece where for 10 minutes in your life it didn't exist. It's an impossibility. If this moment of mind exists now, we know simply it has to go back to a previous moment. So you keep tracking this back until you come out of your mummy's womb. Well, maybe my mind began then. Well, no, how can it begin? This is a really, it seems like an intellectual point, and it is, but once we get our head around this concept, it's quite tasty. We seem to think there should be a first moment of something. We desperately believe that there must be, because the commonest question we all ask, but where did the suffering begin? Where did I begin? We ask that question. On a relative level, what's called Rabina, we can decide, began the moment egg and sperm came together in my mummy's fallopian tube and that they continued to cultivate, multiply the cells, so they didn't go down the toilet with the rest. So that we can deduce from here, this is the Buddha's view, that then at that moment is the beginning of the package called Rabina, and what made the egg and sperm stay together and begin to multiply the cells and turn into the body of Rabina is the entry into that egg and sperm of Rabina's consciousness. So there's the egg and sperm coming together, meeting each other in the fallopian tube, and then we go track back to the consciousness and we go back to the first second of conception. That first second of conception is the beginning of the package called Rabina. That's a fact, when all the pieces come together. So the pieces are the egg, the sperm, and consciousness. So we're tracking back Rabina's consciousness as a river of mental moments from now. We know we're tracking back to that second when they came together in the womb. So we have to ask, okay, what was the second before the egg and sperm came together? Well, we know you track back the egg to mummy's body. You track back the sperm to daddy's body. Well, you track back your consciousness to a previous moment of itself in this river of mental moments. It did not come from mummy, it did not come from daddy, and it did not come from a superior being. The Buddha would say, these are very weird ideas. It came from a previous moment of itself. A simple way to put it. And mind being not physical, and mind going, being able, the Buddhist view, going to a much subtler level of literal of being, of energy, it's at a certain level, our mind doesn't need a body. So this is the point. Our growth, we've got gross consciousness, which is now the body and the mind together, this person, Rabina, living and talking and thinking and with the brain working and thoughts coming out and feelings and doing this and thinking that. This is the gross level of our being. But as soon as we get, you know, through meditation, you can get to what they call subtle consciousness. And if you see a person who's really accomplished these meditation techniques, which are a job of the mind to accomplish, who's gone to these subtler levels of mind that we don't even posit as existing in the materialist view, they would look like they were dead. The big dilemma people have so many times now, people looking like they're dead, suddenly not being dead. It's common, especially this business now. I'm talking, reading this book called The Undead by this American scientist, this medical scientist. And all the dilemmas and problems now because of harvesting organs, you know. The number of times they've had people who think they're dead, they've even cut their livers ready to go, you know. And they're not dead, they come back again. Very distressing. Because the Buddhist view would be, because the gross consciousness is just the tip of the iceberg, and that's the part that's connected to the brain. Once that ceases, and these meditators can get to these subtler levels, where you would literally be not breathing. You're not dead. You're living. You're functioning at the subtle level of consciousness, which does not depend upon this gross bed of bones for its existence. So, of course, we don't posit such a thing in our materialist world. This is the experience of countless people, you know. But we don't kind of believe experience as a valid proof of something. You know, we think it's too subjective. You've got to see it with a microscope, or it doesn't exist. You know. Countless people who leave their bodies. This is a perfect example of the Buddhist explanation. Okay, according to how you interpret that, some people say it's their soul or their spirit. People have different interpretations of that experience. The Buddhist interpretation of that experience is that's your subtle consciousness, a subtle level of your consciousness. And the same as when you dream, that's your subtle consciousness. And it doesn't need this bag of bones to function. So the number of countless experiences of people having out-of-body, as they call it. As I said, everyone interprets it differently according to whether they're Christian or who knows what. But this is the Buddhist interpretation. That's your subtle consciousness. Buddha doesn't use the word soul or spirit. And it doesn't need this body for existing. So if the subtle consciousness is still there, the mind is still in the body at the subtler level, you're not dead yet. That's why in the Buddhist, certainly the Tibetan tradition, you don't touch the body for 3 days. That's the ideal. Before there are certain, and there are very clear indicators, very simple to prove indicators using this model of when the mind has left the body. It's all in the system, you know, when they talk about the death process. It's very clearly laid out. So consciousness is not physical, the Buddha says. And he doesn't use the word spirit or soul. That's the only thing we have. We either talk about mind, this one here, or something weird called spirit or soul, which can't be explained. This is not the Buddha's view. The gross level of our consciousness, which does exist in dependence upon the brain, is just sort of, it goes to a subtler level. There's a continuity. It's the same. It's like the same. There's the same mind. It's just at a subtler level. A subtler level of cognition. And in the long term, indeed, as a Buddhist, we need to get that subtler level in order to really do the work of ridding the mind of all the nonsense and all the causes of suffering, which are in our mind. And this is the business of karma. Getting to karma here. We're getting to karma. We are talking about it, actually, without using the word. So you track yourself back at an unbroken chain of mental moments, and you know very well you keep tracking back the physical to the egg and sperm, and then boom, mummy, boom, daddy. Your mind, where does that track back to? As I said, simple. As a concept, it's simple. As a previous moment of that river of mental moments, clearly a subtler level, because there ain't no egg and sperm there. And a few days before that, or weeks, up to a few weeks, the Buddhist view would say, that consciousness was in a previous body, was the mind of another person. And you track it back again. Well, maybe I began before that, you know. You keep tracking back the same way, and you get back to the first moment of conception of that body. Well, maybe I began then. Well, no, because if you're existing at that moment, that mind, you have to say it came from a previous moment. It's like egg and chicken and egg. It has to come from a previous moment. And you keep tracking. Buddha says it's beginningless, which is a mad idea to our minds. But it's the most logical conclusion from cause and effect. If you posit the concept of cause and effect as a concept that's workable, that's real, if you look at things, then you have to say everything that exists at this moment is a cause, is a result, is an effect. Of what? A cause. And a cause, by definition, is previous. And that previous cause is an effect of a previous cause. And that effect is an effect of a previous cause. And you can never get back to a thing called a first cause. We think we can. We want to. We assume you can. It's not logical if you posit cause and effect. You can't have a thing that is existing that didn't have a previous cause. It's just not possible. What does it come out of? It's an insane, even intellectual impossibility. What to think about this? So this consciousness of ours is my consciousness. It's totally personal. It's completely my consciousness. They're my pleasant feelings. They're my unpleasant feelings. It's my happiness. It's my unhappiness. And it's a feeling I experience in my mind moment by moment. We go back a life before, a trillion years ago, before this planet, you have to keep going. And it's the same with physical matter. The Buddhist view is very simple. That which exists is called physical, which is actually made up of the four elements, just like they used to talk in the Middle Ages, in our culture. Earth, air, fire, water. It's the same model Buddhist still uses. It hasn't changed. It works fine. You track back this cup. You're going to go in an unbroken chain of physical moments back to the first second of this universe. And then you have to go, well, where did that come from? And as His Holiness would say, Big Bang, no problem. It's not the first Big Bang, that's all. That physical matter, and that they would say in this model, it subsumes down to the wind element, the subtlest of the four elements, that is simply the result of previous physical energy. So matter and minds, for the Buddha, simply are beginningless. It's a weird idea to us, because we think there has to be a beginning. Of course, if you're a clever little one at school, you say, well, what caused God? I'll tell you to be quiet. Because it's considered rude. But it's a very reasonable, logical question. Of course, all the teachings in the creative religions, and I'm not complaining, you know, they've got a different way of talking, of course, because they say God is the one that has always existed, and God is the source of everything else. Okay, Buddha just doesn't have that view, that's all. He would argue with that view. He has a different view. Okay. My mind is my mind. It's a beginningless continuity of mental moments. I have moments every single day. They have, in the Buddhist model of the mind, you've got a list of different components of the mind. We'd call them states of mind. They call them mental factors. And there's one grouping called the five always present mental factors. They're parts of our mind, not the brain, the mind, functioning in order for you to function as a reasonable person. Whether you're deluded, whether you're a murderer or a nice person, doesn't matter. These five have to be working in order for a person to function. It's quite intricate explanations in the Buddhist literature, you know, about how the mind works. So one of those is called feeling, as I'm suggesting, and it's a massively important one. And this gets to why we're mistaken in our assessment of the cause, and we're getting to this. All these are the components to understand the causes. So feeling is a huge one, because we'll see, if we look at ourselves and other beings, we are junkies for good feelings. We are frantic every microsecond to have good feelings, that is to say happiness, moment by moment, good feelings. And we are terrified of bad feelings. We are frantic to avoid unpleasant feelings. Is this not true? Look at us. Okay, so, getting to the causes now. And it's so simple, it's embarrassing, it's so disappointing. You're like just building up something huge, and you go, oh, is that all? You'll wait, you'll see. We've talked about this before. Okay, so for the Buddha, another way of looking at the mind, and this is now getting to the karmic business, what karma means. Every microsecond, a person, a sentient being, in Tibetan that's called a mind possessor, is thinking something at the subtlest level or the grossest level. The mind is constantly going, constantly going, constantly going. Feeling is constantly arising, pleasant feelings, unpleasant feelings, and then it's constantly processing, thinking. So each one of those moments of thought, another one of the five always present mental factors is called intention. I want this. I want that. That's what intention means. I will do this. I will walk out the door. I will move my leg. I will scratch my thing. They're pretty instinctive ones, we don't notice. They're more like urges, as Alex Berzin calls them. But another word for intention? Karma. It's a Sanskrit word. It's translated mostly as action. But intention is the one that drives everything. It's the motor that drives our mind. It's a motor that causes our mind to go there and then causes our body and speech to do what the mind wants. Intention drives everything. Intention is the driver. Intention is the main thing that drives all experiences. Intention. And there's every millisecond there's an intention. Very subtle, very gross. I will this. Every one of those intentions, everything our mind does, programs in the mind, stays in the mind, shapes the mind, programs the mind, leaves seeds in the mind, leaves impressions in the mind, leaves grooves in the mind. Whatever words make sense to you. I mean, the mind is not physical, so you just have to use an analogy. Whatever your intentions do, and all the other things the mind does, which is highly complex, you're programming your mind. What is it? Lama Zopa says you're molding your mind into that shape. Every millisecond, we're doing this. So another way to put it, the analogy of seeds and fruits. Every intention, which is called a mental action, which then, if it's a strong one, then like say a typical one, I will kill the mouse. It's called a negative action. We're getting to the causes of happiness and suffering now. That's called a negative action. Now, this has to have a whole big discussion to even understand what a negative action is, as opposed to a positive action. Well, simply speaking, and we'll unpack it, which we have to for karma, a negative action is one that we do first with our mind with an intention. Intention is just bare bones, really. I will kill a mouse. It's neither good nor bad. It's a statement. You've got to look underneath the intention, don't you? You've got to say, well, why do you want to kill a mouse, Rabina? And that's called the motivation, or called we call it the reason. It's so packed into the intention when it's habitual, you never question. But there's an intention, I will kill the mouse. And you go, well, why are you killing the mouse? Well, I can't stand mice. What do you think? So then we go, oh, what's that called? So then we get to the Buddhist model of the mind, and we have many, many different negative states of mind, positive states of mind, and neutral states of mind. The negative ones are these neurotic states of mind that are neurotic I-based, that are fearful, I-based, to get what I want. And they're deluded, and coming to it, they are the ones that motivate the I will kill intention, which is the karma, that leaves a seed. And if it's called because I can't stand mice, well, you label that, and that's called anger. That's called anger. There are many packages in this model of the mind, and there's a group of them called the delusions. And there's a group of 20 secondary delusions, and there's a group called the six root delusions. And then there's get that down to three, the three main ones. Attachment, anger or aversion, and then indifference. So take indifference away, and you've got attachment and aversion. If we look at the feelings, unpleasant feelings, we have aversion to that thing, which triggers an unpleasant feeling. We have attraction to that thing, which triggers rushing after it because it looks good. We believe getting the delicious thing, which is the object of attachment, is the cause of a happy feeling. We think that. And then we think the ugly thing, which triggers aversion, is the cause of my unhappy feeling. This is a process of karma, of samsara, of daily life. And it's all built in instinctively because Buddha says we come fully programmed with all these habits from countless lives. We come fully programmed. Just like the West says we come programmed from mummy and daddy, Buddha says we come programmed from ourself. That's all. Same concept. Programmed into this process. Desperate for happy feelings every millisecond. Something out there looks good. Attachment makes it look delicious. You grasp after it. Believing it'll make me happy. You're craving for happiness and you're craving for not to have suffering. You see an ugly thing? Oh my God, that's the cause of suffering. Can't stand that. Push it away. Ugly. Keep. Punch. Mouse. Shoot. Kill the mouse. Cause of suffering. Can't stand it. That's called aversion or anger. Then you put your hand, you get your foot. The mouse is there. You kill the mouse and the mouse dies. That's a complete action of what's called killing, which is called a negative action. And what makes it a negative action, first of all, is because mice don't want to die. You do your market research and you discover that no one likes to get killed. And Buddha says that's enough to make it a negative action. It's not because God said or he said or it's up in the moon somewhere it's a negative action. It's because you can prove it pretty simply. You do a market research in this room, everybody will say they don't want to get killed. Everybody will say they don't want to be harmed, don't like being lied to, don't like being stolen from. This is Buddha's view of what a negative action is. It's a practical thing you can prove. It's not coming from God or Buddha or up on high or mummy or daddy or judges or the government. It's a natural law. No one likes suffering. Therefore, that's what harming another is called a negative action. Harming another is what's called a negative action. So, here we have I want to be happy, it's driving me. Due to my culture, I see a mouse, aversion arises instantly. How dare a mouse be in my kitchen? And why is that there? Because I have attachment to feeling happy. Desperate, like a junkie, to feel happy every second. And a mouse comes along and dares to upset my happiness, basically. So then I think I'm going to kill it. We get all these logical reasons, well, it's dirty, and it does, you know, all this, and we think it like sounds so clear, it sounds like so intelligent. Oh, well, it's dirty, it'll cause sickness, I must kill it, we say. But basically, it's aversion. Because I believe the mouse is causing my suffering, don't I? So then I'm going to get rid of the mouse, so I'll kill it. So that's called a negative action. An action, first of all, there's the intention, I will kill the mouse. That's the very meaning of the word karma. And then there's a reason behind it, packed into it, aversion. And that aversion, and then the body in this case, the foot, carrying out the wish of my mind, I will kill the mouse, the foot stomps on it, and then the mouse dies, and you go, great. That's called a complete negative action of killing. What makes it negative is not even the intention to kill. What makes it negative first in general is that mice don't like getting killed. It harms the mouse. That's what makes it called negative. But when I do it, what makes it negative for me and therefore leaves an imprint in my mind is my wishing to harm the mouse. That's what pollutes my mind. That's what sows a seed of negativity in my mind. That's what sows a negative seed in my mind. And that negative seed, eventually one day, and it's all highly complex how it works, will ripen in various ways as my suffering. So the answer to the question, what's the cause of happiness? Well, let's get first the cause of suffering. The cause of my suffering is my past negative actions. That's how you unpack it. That's the answer. The cause of happiness is exactly the same, except it's a virtuous motivation. You see the mouse, it's suffering. Oh, the poor little mouse, I can't stand this suffering. Little mouse, I must help it. You pick it up, you put it in a safe place, you blow mantras on it, you keep it safe, you love it, you don't want it to suffer. That's called a virtuous action. You could have put the mouse up in the box thinking it was dead, so there's no intention. The intention to put the mouse off the floor into a box is not virtuous or non-virtuous. You might have thought it was dead. I'll get the dirty thing out of the way. So you put the mouse in the box on the corner where it's safe, but you didn't mean to help it. You didn't mean to harm it. It was like indifferent. Who cares? But if you had the thought, the wish, I want to help the mouse, that's a virtuous thought. That's virtuous. It's just the nature of it. A virtuous one is where you're connected to the other, you empathize with their pain, you want them to be happy, you want to help them. That's a virtuous thought, a virtuous feeling. It's very powerful. Every single one of those thoughts we have sows a seed in our mind, programs our mind, and that will ripen in the future as your moments of pleasant feelings. That's the Buddha's explanation to what the cause of happiness is. And what the cause of suffering is. Did you hear all that? Did it make sense? So if it's true, as he's saying, because it seems pretty outrageous, because it all happens so spontaneously, it's also like a miraculous movie playing itself out. The Buddha says this is how every sentient being exists. It's the way it is for every single sentient being, whether it's a dog or a human or a person being raped or a person being terrorized or tortured, a person winning $1 million in the lottery, a person with the most divine husband since Brad Pitt or what. I mean, just joking. You understand my point? Whatever the thing is, the divine happiness, the small happiness, the miniature happiness, the most intense suffering, the middle suffering, the tiniest suffering, every single one is broken down into moments, moments, moments. You unpack it like a movie. It's millions of little stills, you know? And we took the pictures in the past. We programmed our mind in the past. We took all the photos in the past and now we're playing out our own movies. It's one way to say it. Every microsecond is our movie playing out. We shot this movie. We created that suffering. We created that happiness. As Lama Zopaput said, everything we're seeing and hearing is our own karmic appearance. It's our own movie playing back. It's a really nice way to put it, but it's technically meant to be the way. It's not just some cosmic idea. So if it is true every sentient being is the cause from their own past, intentions and motivations and actions and all the myriad things we do every microsecond, and planting all those seeds in our mind, and also intuitive, we don't even notice it, this is a tragedy. If we are literally the creators of our own happiness and of our own suffering, and we know we want happiness and don't want suffering, there's a conclusion. I'd better stop creating negativity and I'd better start being a nice person. And don't underestimate this. Don't think, oh, that's just being self-centered. Yeah, but hey, what a sensible self-centeredness. Because it'll bring you happiness. Weatherboss. This is Buddha's observation. This is his observation. He did not make this up. He is not the creator. There's no one up there pulling the strings. Happiness is not a reward for being a good girl. Punishment is not bad things is not punishment for being a bad girl, which is how we think about it. We think of it as a dualistic punishment reward system. It's monstrous to think this way. It's rubbish to think this way for the Buddha. But we do this so instinctively. This is a practical issue, you know. It's practical. But it doesn't seem like this, does it? Who would have thought it was this? Till you hear what Buddha says. Any questions about all that? Whoops, Daisy, my glasses just went. Sorry, under there somewhere, darling. Can you see them? Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. So do you have any questions from all that? Did you miss in some things? Did you memorize it all, write it all down? Because this is the recipe of how to get happy, basically. I just gave you the recipe, okay? What do you think, Tracy? What, darling?
Good morning.
Good morning.
thank you, Venerable Robin.
Where are you? Yeah. Who's got it? Where are you? Oh, yes. Go.
Yeah.
Yes, yes.
So when you were explaining...
Bit closer to the mic, sweetie. Treat it like an ice cream. Close to the mouth.
When you were explaining karma and how karmic seeds are planted and how it's a kind of a complex process as to how later on...
Sorry, what?
How it's a complex process as to how later on that ripens as suffering again.
That's right.
I just wanted to ask a simple way that I have of understanding it, and if I'm right or wrong, right or wrong in that understanding, is that, let's say, as with the example of the mouse, when you have that aversion and that suffering at that time because of those intentions to kind of kill it and, like, how dare it be in my house causing me suffering, and then you take that negative action, then after, like, you complete that negative action, let's say next time in the future when a similar thing happens, you've programmed your mind to create more suffering at similar circumstances.
Or something like that. Yeah, if you think of it as programming or seed, whatever analogy works, then you can see it's just like, okay, you're basically right, yeah, sure. So in other words, if you programmed your mind every day, you're programming your mind every day if you're playing piano every day, aren't you? You're learning to play piano, aren't you? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And you're programming yourself, basically, to become really brilliant at piano. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah.
Yeah. You're leaving the tendencies in your mind. The point is that Buddha says, when we die, your mind continues. It's inevitable. Your mind can never cease. That all the programming will continue. And certain amounts of it will ripen. Even before you die, certain programming will come to the surface. Like, what's your name?
Brandon.
Brendan or Brandon?
Brandon. With
A.
Yeah.
Brandon, okay. So then Brandon, he's the result of a complex coming together of many seeds and many karmas at the time of your past death that was programmed that you must have died reasonably, you must have died like any of us who are human, the Buddha would say. You know, you died reasonably, the morality was in the mind, you'd practiced a spiritual path before, you must have practiced strong morality, and then you died fairly peacefully. That triggered one of your billions of karmic seeds in your big bank vault of virtuous karmic seeds, in this case a virtuous one, from consciously not harming others before and consciously helping them. One of those seeds ripened, which programmed your mind to then go running when you passed away into your mummy's human womb, as opposed to the mouse womb or the dog womb or God knows what other womb. So just then, the first way your karma ripens is in getting a human birth. I'll go into this in a minute, the four ways karma ripens. So you program your mind, and this programming can't go away. And then whatever's most prevalent will manifest, and that's a person called Brandon, with Brandon's movie playing out, you know, created by Brandon. I mean, it doesn't seem evident in the beginning, and it's all there in the literature, and then learning it and thinking it through and meditating on it is when we eventually get the experience of how this is so. But something like what you said, yes, sure.
Thank you.
Did one up here.
Okay. Sure.
Hi.
Hi.
So you said something about in the observation, you know, everything's cause and effect. You can keep going back and going back and going back, and then at the end of life, you know, the consciousness is there. And you said something about it was Buddha's observation that something happened, like said something about it, that that the consciousness, even though it appears it's in a subtle consciousness state, and it appears that there's no consciousness, but it's a subtle consciousness.
Yeah.
So would one take the next leap from that thought that perhaps we are harming people by, like, sending them to be cremated, you know, or...
Before they're dead, yeah, sure, absolutely.
No. Subtle consciousness
leaves the body, definitely. It could be very it could be very difficult for the person, yeah, because when yes, absolutely. So I'll talk a bit about that now for a second, but we'll go into, what's your name?
Vicky,
okay. Yeah, at the moment happened to be editing a book of Lama Zopa Rinpoche's about how to help people at the time of death. And he's stressing hugely in this the incredible responsibility of a person who helps a person die. That it's almost like the most important time to help that person in your life, their life, is at the time of death. This highly this difficult time for most people because we have so much fear and grasping at life. We've never thought about impermanence. We don't want to know about death. We're living in denial of death. So for most people, it's a very painful time. So it's a really important time to help a person, and the most precious, important thing to do is make the conditions as conducive as possible to have a peaceful mind. That means peaceful and virtuous kind of come together. Unpeaceful and freaking out and negative and ego grasping come together. So it's such a sensitive time. It's like going through a huge war zone, like a huge storm. You've got to really protect the person through that so they die with a happy mind, which triggers a virtuous karmic seed, which can throw them into a nice mummy's womb, you know, a nice human mummy's womb. So for sure, it can be really wretched if you start, you know, bashing the person and shouting and yelling or having lots of strong emotions, even when they've passed away, because there are many reports of people who have gone into a coma but who are totally conscious because their subtle consciousness is there and they're hearing what's going on. It's very common. So treating them with incredible respect, making it peaceful. Of course, Buddhists would have all these prayers and make it calm for them so that they can go through that process, and it takes up to 3 days. It can, for the consciousness finally to leave the body. And then there's methods of checking when the mind has left. Then you do what you like. Feed it to the dogs. It doesn't matter. Actually, they feed them. They call it, one way they have it in Tibet, they call it sky burial, where the whole attitude is you want to offer your body to the animals. You want to give your body away, you know. So then when the person's dead, they get these guys whose job it is, they take it up to the top of the mountain, they cut up all the bits and pieces, all the soft bits there, all the yucky bits here, all the bones, and all the big vultures are waiting. And then they call them and boom, down. Body gone in about 10 minutes, you know. Offer your body to the vultures. Very good. So they have that. It's a very efficient way to do it. All the real estate we use for stupid dead bodies is silly, you know. Anyway, that's my opinion. Excuse me. That's not Buddha's view. That was Rabbinaism. That wasn't Buddhism. Yeah. Go on. Yep. Oh, here. Okay. Go, darling.
Hi. My name is Viviani.
Viviani, yes.
First, I don't know if it's okay. I would like to share something that happened today.
What do you mean?
With me.
What do you mean it happened to you? In your mind?
No, it's an experience that happened this morning, and it has a lot to do with what you are teaching today.
So you, I want to debate with you for a second.
Yes, and also
I want to debate with you.
I have a question.
Okay, good.
When you're talking,
so ask the question and leave the experience.
Okay.
It's nice to hear. Have it in tea time. You can tell people
no,
in the tea time.
No, because it will raise a question too. That's why.
Well, what's your question?
But when you're talking about giving an example with the mice, that you have the aversion and you have the attraction. Right? When you have the aversion, you want to kill it because you feel, you don't feel.
Okay, good. That's right. So what's the question?
And what if, and the attraction would be the opposite. What about that if you have an aversion to the mice, but you don't kill the mice, you just let
Okay,
go.
We'll go into all that. That's the karma. We'll go into that.
Push him away
we'll
from
go
the
into
house.
That. We'll go into that. We'll go into that.
Okay.
Viviani, we'll go into that. Thank you.
And
it'll all come slowly to talk about karma all day. You'll answer all that.
Yeah. And I would like to ask, because based on what happened, when you were talking about your mind is already being programmed, and a lot of the happiness comes from external, what's the word? Conditions. And Like my daughter, she's 2.5 years old. So she's really young. And a lot of things, what she did today, it's not something I never imprinted on her.
That's right, exactly.
And she woke up this morning and I showed her the sunrise.
Yeah.
And it was all pink.
Yes.
And she just looked, she's like, oh, it's pink. It's my favorite. I'm so happy.
So then, what's
the point?
Those
3 words that she said on her own.
No. But so, what's the point you're making?
And is that would be? It's not something that would be something karmic. That's something that comes from her.
Yeah, but what's
her own? She's already has this attachment of happiness based on something external. But it's not something that I ever taught her.
You don't need. Okay, thank you, Viviana. That's a good example. Yeah. The point is, because we're all programmed with these tendencies, this instinctive craving every single moment. Okay, it'll all come up slowly. I want to unpack the pieces as we go along, and I hope it all comes together as a coherent thing, slowly, slowly. So that's a very good example. Thank you. It is that, yes. Okay, it is exactly that. In just the same way, another little child I know about, the son of my friend, he's now like 40, but when he was a 3-year-old boy, she was taking the lice out of his head, and he was crying in compassion for the lice. Mommy, don't hurt them, it's their home. So that is the same thing. She did not teach him that. Another child, 3 years old, sees fishing and is so excited and can't wait to run to go fishing, to kill the fish. That made him happy. So whatever it is, whether it's a sunrise, life generates compassion, fishing, you want to go fishing. These are imprints in the mind. Everything is our own past movie that it's an example. And so then we play it out from the second we began in this life. That's right. So the mother, the father, teach the children things. But there's an imprint in the mind, a seed in the mind, that if it weren't there, they wouldn't learn it. So the seed has to be there to be, you know, like that. And that's whether it's fishing you see, it's a sunrise you see, or it's compassion for life, it's imprinted in the mind, yeah. Because if a child had another person had a very deluded mind, a very unhappy mind, always suffering every minute, they see a sunrise and just go, who cares? They'd be bored, you know? Do you understand? Yeah. Sweetheart. Okay. Yeah.
Wait a minute.
Yeah.
Okay. My question is, because I want my notes to really be succinct.
Yes, yeah.
And so you started with the 5 mental factors that's always present.
Always, that's right.
I want the other 3, please.
Okay, this intention, which is the really meaning of karma. Intention.
The first one was feeling.
No, the first one's intention, really.
Intention.
That's the main one, intention, which drives everything. That's another word for karma.
Okay.
The thought to do something, intention. Then you go to it more precisely, so that's called attention. Attention.
Attention.
Then there's called discrimination, which is an ability to think it's this or that. Then there's called feeling.
Well, feeling is way down here.
Oh, it doesn't matter the order they call. But I think I forgot the fifth one. What's it called? Contact. So that comes before feeling. So there's intention, attention, discrimination, contact, feeling. So there's intention, then it goes to actually do, which is attention. Then you can discriminate, is it this or this or this, which is a type of intelligence. Then there's contact when all these conditions come together, the pink and the thought come together and the eye consciousness all come together, and then it triggers a feeling.
Thank you.
Pleasant, unpleasant, or indifferent. And then comes attachment or aversion. And then comes suffering. Yeah, okay. Yes.
Morning. You were talking.
Where are you?
I'm right here. You were talking about the two the subtle and the gross.
In the tantric model, which I find helpful, it's not in the, when you study the mental factors, which is from the sutra teachings, you don't learn about gross, subtle, and very subtle. But I find it a helpful model. So I'm taking it from the higher model called tantra, and they talk about gross, subtle, very subtle. There's just levels of
consciousness. Yes, actually, the very subtle. That's what I was thinking.
The very subtle is the subtlest one before you die.
And you said that you get that through intense meditation.
No, we get it every time we go to, it just happens naturally every time you go to sleep, every time you die. Naturally, you go through this process of deconstruction, and the mind gets to the very subtle level every time. But we're not conscious of it. We've not learned to use it every time we go to sleep.
That was my question.
Yeah.
I wanted to know if sentient beings were connecting with that at their moment of death. So you answered my question. I wanted to know if all sentient beings come in contact with their most subtle consciousness.
It happens every time, but it's like driving past this beautiful scenery every day with your eyes closed. You go past it every day, but you don't see it. So, but because we're not capable of being conscious at a subtler level, we've not practiced. We're so addicted to the gross level that even when we go to sleep, it's mostly just unconsciousness. We might have a few weird dreams occasionally. That's subtle consciousness. We never go anywhere near awareness of being at the subtle, very subtle. And that's why all these meditations, it's necessary with these training of concentration to be able to access in your own meditation with at great discipline and much work to get to the subtler level, because that's the most potent, most powerful, most perfect, capable level of mind that is able, if you're ready, to get enlightened, actually.
Are you connected with your most subtle level?
What do you mean by connected? Who?
You.
Oh, no way. No. Of course not. It's highly advanced for the great tantric yogis, you know. So then, okay. One more. Okay. Then I'll go into more detail.
Venerable, I'm over here.
Okay.
I just wanted to ask you, you just referred to a book about death and dying.
Yeah, the one I'm working on at the moment, of Love
right.
and Purpose. It should be coming out hopefully in the middle, you know, like in the early next year.
Oh, early
this year.
This
coming out this year at some point.
2014. Do you have a name for that book yet?
Well, I know what I want to call it, but I think the wisdom will freak out, and all their marketing people will freak out completely. I'm calling it How to Help Your Loved Ones Die Well or something. Die Joyfully and then go, or something, I forget now. And then go happily to their next rebirth. I don't think they're going to call it this. They'll freak out because no one likes the word death. But I don't know, something like that, but it's by Lama Zopa, and it'll be Wisdom Publications publishing it. And it should be in the next few months when I get the manuscript to them. Yeah. And it's addressed to helpers. And it's as if it's your loved one. It's all about your loved one. It could be anybody. And anyone who's dying could also read it. And it's all very structured. All the first part is all about the philosophy of impermanence and how death is important. We understand it. And then there's a really crucial part about the death process itself, the 12 links and the 8 stages of death and exactly what happens and how to be aware of it and what goes on where and how and what, like the technical side. And then there's the actual stages of what, like the first one is how to make the environment really conducive. It's all about bullet points and numbers and everything. And then there's a section on the few weeks and months before death, then the days before death, another chapter on the hours before death, and there's a chapter on what happens at the time of death, when the breath stops, what to do, what practices, what thing to do, and then the days after death, and then the 49 days, the cremation, and then the 49 days. All the stages to go through, exactly what, lots and lots of practices. I mean, and then trying to put them in some are quite complex, but getting them down to the essence, and they're all listed in the back, and it's sort of trying to make it like a how-to book, you know. There'll be a bibliography, yes. Sure, absolutely.
Thank you.
Okay.
And Ravina, just to say for everybody, we're doing Death and Dying workshops every month.
Very important, yeah, brilliant. So good. Absolutely. Yes, fantastic, good. Okay, so I want to unpack this basic idea that our consciousness is a continuity. Every microsecond of what we think and do and say leaves an imprint. Those imprints, whether they're negative or positive, forget the neutral ones, neutral too, will then ripen as suffering or happiness. It's not technically, it is fascinating technically, but it's such a different explanation of how we think. We can't see it this way because we're addicted to the other way of interpreting. Because it's very simple. For us, happiness is what you get when you get the thing, and suffering is what when you get the ugly thing. And all Buddha's saying is it's not quite. It's not correct. There's some partial truth in it, but we haven't got the whole story. We've missed the fundamental one, is that it's a past season in your mind that trigger you to even meet that ugly thing, for you to even meet the delicious thing. You even created a cause for that. It's not out there from its own side at all. It's the karmic appearance of your past actions. This is what's most fascinating. So, okay, one way to look at it is that your karma, your past actions, your past mental actions, and those then also, you know, completed by the body and speech, carrying out the mental thoughts, wishes, actions of your body, speech, and mind, they can ripen in any of four ways. And again, this is all highly complex. The technical, how it works, you know, the actual way it works is highly complex. Like I indicated already with Brandon, the first way your karma ripens is the main karma at the time of death is the one that causes the type of rebirth you're going to get. So here again we can have an entire conversation about the different kinds of rebirth. Because from the bigger picture point of view in Buddhism, this is necessary to really understand the levels of suffering that he is talking about. Because he doesn't just talk about in this life the moments of unpleasantness and the moments of pleasantness, which is happiness and suffering. He's got a broader interpretation in terms of types of rebirth. Types of rebirth. So it's a much vaster picture, and so it's helpful to understand this if we're going to understand what Buddha's on about. So for him, there's this whole spectrum of possibility of types of mental experiences, and another way of saying a realm. And there's a bunch. We're all in this one category of types of beings called the desire realm. The desire realm. And within this, there are six kinds of sentient beings. All from the top end of samsara, where it's like the best suburbs, to the most intense suffering suburbs. All within the desire realm. All sentient beings, all experiencing the fruits of their past actions. So if virtuous karmic seeds ripen at the time of death, and again, as the whole system's kind of complex, then if that's the main karma that ripens, they call that the throwing karma, the one in Brandon's case, as I use, and therefore for all of us, the one that ripened from your vault of billions of virtuous karmic seeds that was triggered by the way you died, all the conditions come together, it triggers that virtuous seed from virtuous actions he did in the past, it's stored away there. This has ripened at the time of his death, and even before he stops breathing in the past life, already this is manifesting. Already it's already been ripened, it hasn't ripened yet, that's not until he gets into mummy's womb, but it's already become triggered. And already there's indicators in the person's own way they die. If people are freaking out at the time of death, that can be an indicator that a negative seed has ripened. And they're already the mind is getting more subtle, and you're already seeing the horrible future lives, you know. The virtuous one, can, you know, so in his case, or in our case, a virtuous karmic seed ripened. That then, also at the same time, also triggered millions of other karmic seeds that will become the other three ways your karma ripens. And all this already is congealing into place as the whole person. The second thing about, let's say in the case of Brandon, his tendencies or his personality, whether he's a psycho or whether he's, you know, wants to jump on everybody else's girlfriends or whether he's wants to kill or whether he's paranoid or whether he's loving or kind or generous, whatever the qualities are. Our own personality, our own tendencies, our own characteristics. And again, we are addicted to believing that they come from mummy and daddy. They're functions of our genes and our DNA and our treatment. We truly, again, believe on this innocent little package. An empty vessel gets plonked on this earth that has things done to it, that then cause me to be who I am. Buddha says it's a misconception. There's some truth in that, but it's not the whole story, he says. We come programmed with our own tendencies, not from mummy and daddy, not racial tendencies, not any kind of from external. They're our own tendencies. From our own past practice of negativity or positivity. So the second way our karmic seeds from the past, our habits from the past can ripen in the present is in our habit to keep killing, our habit to keep lying, our habit to be paranoid, our habit to be loving, generous, compassionate, our habit to be happy, to be triggered, to be peaceful, to be kind. Little girl to see pink and she gets happy. Her happiness, an ability to be happy, to feel joyful. These are all our own tendencies. They don't come from our genes. They don't come from mummy and daddy. They don't come from a creator. They don't come from nowhere. They're not random. They're our own. We come programmed with our own tendencies. This is kind of tasty. It really demands accountability. You know, can't blame anybody, including yourself. The next way your karma ripens is they call it experiences similar to the cause. So if you play out your movie of your life, the outside world, that's experiences. The people you're born to, the country you're born to, the kinds of people. If you're born into a war zone, or ugly people, or abusers, or loving people, or rich people, or poor people, or mean people, or junky people, or people who lie to you, steal from you, don't believe your words, want to harm you, want to love you, give you things, whatever that movie is, and I'm not trying to use these terms very vague, but I mean it sincerely. And we utterly believe it's all out there. I'm this innocent victim plonked into that horrible family. Or I'm this innocent victim plonked into a good family, but who cares? I'm just happy. Thanks a lot. More, please. You know, we don't care about why good things. We only worry about why bad things. Well, the answer is the same for both. So if the tendency is the habit of having done something before, another result is the experience of having done it to you from having done it before. So the consequence, one of the consequences of killing, if killing ripened in Brandon's rebirth, Brandon's mind before at the time of his past death, not more than a few weeks before he zapped into his mummy's human womb, if killing had been the main karma, you know, conditioned by all the way he died and a lot of anger, a lot of fear, the habit of killing was in his mind, you know, he'd never looked at himself, he'd never looked at his mind, hadn't practiced, that would have been the one triggered even before he stopped breathing, which then would have been the cause, let's say, to be born into a rat's mummy's womb, as opposed, you know, the rat underneath the house. He might have karma with his human mummy, but he gets the rat's womb instead. Because, you know, that's the experience. You get born as a rat body, into a rat body with a rat mind. So that when you get the rat karma ripening, the same time all the personality of rat will come. It's not as if karmic seeds of an intelligent person will pop up and get a rat body instead. Well, I mean, that would be quite confusing. A rat body has a mind that suits it. Your mind kind of joins the rat house, you know, and then you get the qualities that go with that. They're addicted to sex, apparently. They love sex, rats. They have sex all day. They've got teeth like steel. They're good killers. All these tendencies. All those seeds would have been in his mind, latent, and then they come ripening at the same time. The rat karma ripens, which is the first one, the type of rebirth. Then his tendencies all pop up that suit the rat body. Then the experiences of a rat. Humans just see a rat and they have a panic attack and want to smash it to pieces immediately. So they live underneath and they're paranoid and they kind of get things, whatever rats do, you know. And the way rats are received by others, their experience. And the fourth one is environmental karma. The way the physical world impacts upon you, you know, how the physical world. So using one example of killing, if it ripens at the time of death as the main karma, the throwing karma they call it, you'll be born in one of the suffering realms of existence. An animal, a spirit, or a hell being. Buddha posits three main types of mental experience realms that are the fruit of a negative karmic seed ripening at the time of death, the main karma. And these, and they're progressively more suffering, mental suffering. They're intensely suffering. This is the fruit of a negative karmic seed ripening at the time of death, which gives you that kind of realm. Then the second way killing ripens, we can see, we might get a human birth, which is the fruit of virtuous karma ripening at the time of death. But killing ripens as a tendency. Most humans kill something. Look at this. Most humans kill something. Even most religions say it's okay. I was taught as a Christian. God said he gave souls to humans. He made animals for our benefit. It's a different view. Buddha says we're all sentient beings. We've all been human countless times. All been rats countless times. All been gods countless times. That's one of the virtuous results. We've all been spirits and hell beings countless times. They're all sentient beings with different types of physical energy, some subtle, some gross, all with different mental states, different tendencies, different experiences, all created by themselves in the past. This is not punishment. It's not reward. Every sentient being is the creator of their own reality. And it's kind of enough to make your heart break with compassion, first for yourself and then for others. Because one of the worst sufferings is that we don't realize this. We think it's everybody else who does it to us, which perpetuates the suffering. So it's quite an intense view, you know. But it's very empowering if we can take it on board, because it means stopping blaming, stopping the anger, stopping the hurt, stopping the resentment, stopping the self-pity me. Okay, it takes a life, because I'm the boss. I become accountable, you know, because I realize it's up to me. Up to me to stop creating the causes of suffering and start creating the causes of happiness. Because if I don't do it, baby, who will? Because it's my job, because I created my own reality. So the four ways your karma ripens. One is the type of realm. So I was talking about the realms. I'll go to that. One is a type of a tendency. One is an experience of it happening to you. And one is even called environmental. So one of the results of killing environmentally would be if it manifests environmentally for you. And it might not be a tendency. Some people live. So you can get any of these four. You get the realm, the type of realm. Then forget that one. But in this life as a human, we can deduce it was virtue that created our human life. But we can see the different other three kinds. Some people have lots of tendency to kill, but they might never get killed. Because the consequence of the experience of killing, the first card, the one called action similar to the cause, that's the tendency. The action similar to the cause is the tendency. That's from having killed before. The experience similar to the cause is you getting killed, you dying young, you getting sick. The environmental is the environment, the air, the water, the food doesn't nourish you. It actually harms you. And that could be any environment, you know. You could be living in a. You could have an allergy to peanuts and die. That's environmental karma of past killing. I'm going to produce these notes, which I do every year. I didn't do it this year, but I will do it, and they'll be printed, and they'll be out there tomorrow. If people can please take a copy, or you can get the PDF and have it downloaded, both, if you wish. And I'm going to have a teaching in there about this, going into more detail about this, so we've got the facts there, and plus other teachings as well, which you can have, which will help you. This is Buddha's explanation. And keep remembering, Buddha's not a creator. This is his observation. This is his own observation of reality. Now, I'm not saying he's right or wrong. I'm taking it on board as if it were. I'm using it as my hypothesis, as what I'm using in my life to interpret my life. You know, that's our choice. And slowly, slowly with practice, we get to see the truth of it. So, okay, the realms of existence is most interesting, you know. Because this is something that really feels weird to us. And the main reason it feels weird to us is because we have this immense grasping. This is the deepest delusion in our mind. The deepest, most primordial grasping at the status quo, at who I am. So we can see how we identify ourselves. We can see this. Who am I, you know? So we can see one of the major ones we have is gender. One of the major ones, in certain countries, or in every country actually, I think it's race. We can see it, and depending on your country, depending on where you are, your environment, it can be very, one can be quite powerful. If you live in a place where there's only one race, well, you don't think of yourself as a race, you just think of yourself as you. But if there's two races, then there's going to be an alternative, so you're going to think of yourself as this one or that one, isn't it? As soon as we have alternatives, you identify with one of them. We always, one of the ways ego is, we identify with our people. And it can be a good thing or it can be a bad thing. We can see this, you know. I remember asking my friends in prison quite a lot. I'd do surveys and I'd say, how do you identify yourself more? In terms of your race or in terms of your gender? Every one of them, all the black, all the white, all the Asian, they all said gender was more fundamental. That's interesting, isn't it? Maybe the gay ones didn't answer. I'm not sure. Or the ones who are, you know, becoming a boy from a girl. Now that's very different, isn't it? But generally you'd think race is quite powerful because that's the big one. Oh, there's this group and there's that group. We all love to divide ourselves into groups. You see, animals do it. Everybody does it. You know? So what I'm getting at is how we identify who I am. And it's very referential, isn't it? It's very kind of related to where you are around. It's very contextual. We can't help but do this. But like I said, you know, if you just only got one group, you don't think of yourself as that group until you see another group that you can kind of compare yourself with. You get my point? But we always have this view, a vivid view of who we think we are. Or I'm fat, or I'm thin, or I'm a park carpenter, or I'm beautiful, or I've got nice eyelashes, or I've got good ears, or I'm a very good car, you know, anything. We take whatever it is about ourselves, and then we say, that's me. We have a very vivid way of defining who I am. Very vivid. And we hold on to that. And that's why we can't change, why we're stuck in our misery. Because we all think, I'm very depressed, I'm ugly, I'm unintelligent, I'm this, I'm that, I'm jealous, I'm hopeless, I'm unloved. We have a vivid picture in our mind. We'd write a little novel about who we think we are. We all got a very vivid picture of who I am, myself. And then we stay stuck in it. And that's the biggest problem, because we think it can't change. And then we reinforce that definition every day. This is the way delusions work. They're stuck in stone, you know. So the point is, the Buddha's view, this is where emptiness, we're talking about emptiness here. We are those things. We are. I am an Australian, 69-year-old, female, Buddhist nun. That's a fact. All those things. Tick the boxes, I'm all of those things. I'm American as well, actually. And I promised I'd have allegiance to America. They asked me, I said, can I keep my other passports when I did my thing? And she said, yes, but we don't mind how many passports you have, as long as you have allegiance to the United States. And I promised I would. That means if the United States and Australia go to war, I've got to be an American. And I promised, listen, I promised I'd bear arms. I was not lying. Okay, never mind. So, okay, so we identify ourselves in this conventional way, isn't it? I'm this, I'm an American, I'm Australian, I'm this race, I'm that gender, I'm whatever I might be. And then the thing is, they this is the point now, they are relative facts. You can't say they're not. They're relative facts. But this is the way delusions work, Buddha says, and this has got to do with emptiness. That we over-exaggerate that and we stay stuck in it. We over-define it. We over-exaggerate that and sort of believe it's that's who I am in my bones. And that's why, what I'm getting to, reincarnation sounds so bizarre to us. So many people who think of reincarnation will think, oh, you know, if I'm a girl, I'm a girl in my nature, so I must become another girl. Even weird to become a boy, you know, that seems too much. Because what I'm getting at is how we define ourselves according to the status quo. So then to think you can become a girl if you're a boy, but even more to become a rat if you're a human, this seems too bizarre. So this needs thinking about. And the way Buddha's describing it is that all these sentient beings, they're all mind possessors, equal in wishing to be happy, equal in wishing not to suffer, equal in being beginningless, continuity is a mental moment, equal in that they're experiencing every microsecond the fruits of their past seeds planted in their mind. So the more we think that, which implies cause and effect, and which does imply emptiness, there's nothing set in stone. You are, I am a 16-year-old, whatever I am, blah, blah. That's a fact. But it's not who I am in my bones, is the point. And then when you go through the death process, and they talk about it in great detail, which is very helpful, it's just basically this deconstructing of this package. By the time you stop breathing, all your senses have ceased. All your gross capacity to put two and two together have ceased. You have no idea any longer who you are. You've lost the plot. You know this vivid sense of who we think we are in terms of I am this person with these kind of friends and this kind of people, this kind of music, this football team, this big drama we have that was me and in the world that I live in and how I fit into it. That's how we think about ourselves. By the time you stop breathing, you have lost the plot completely. There's none of that left. And you keep deconstructing the gross, the subtle to the very subtle, where you get to what they call the very subtle consciousness, which is the subtlest level of your being beyond which you can't be subtler, inextricably linked with the very subtle level of these four elements. And this is the fundamental building blocks of the new person. And what causes it to manifest as a new person is the ripening of these karmic seeds, these tendencies, these grooves, this training in the mind, this programming. So at by the time you get the level of very subtle consciousness, there's no human left. There's no male, there's no female, there's no black, there's no white, there's no Asian, there's no dog, there's no anything. It's just all potentials. The human package of Robina has now gone, fallen off the wall like Humpty Dumpty and is finished. Gone. Done. Over. Disappeared. Finished. There's now only the tendencies that have already ripened that is going to produce the new person. So if the negative karma ripens at the time of death, so I'm going to get created the cause to be born to a rat mummy, and then all the conditions coming along for the tendencies of a rat, for the experiences of the rat, and the environmental karma of the rat, all that's packaged ready to go, I'll leave the body, and it won't be long before I find a rat body, because there are plenty of rat mummies around, babe. Won't take long. The grasping is powerful. You rush into this intermediate state, like a dream state, and before long you'll find the new mummy rat with whom you have strong history, strong karmic connections. No, just random rat out there. It's your mummy rat. You're super attracted. Your mind runs to that rat mummy. It looks super delicious. You can't wait to get there. And boom, you join a rat house now. And then the rat manifestation, the rat mind comes. You do what rats do. All the karma you created is Robina. The good things, they're all there, but they're underneath. You can't access them now. They didn't ripen. They're sitting there latent in my little bank vault, in my consciousness. But now the rat karma's ripened. The human karma's ripened. So you get human tendencies, hopefully. The tragedy is 90% of us don't use them. This is a tragedy. We just tip our life down the toilet and go right back to the rat one again by killing and harming, which are the cause of that kind of suffering. There's other kinds of rebirth. They call them spirits. Everyone talks about spirits, ghosts. You think of, you know, you hear about a house and somebody's like, they see this lady in 18th century costume. Well, that's a being who did live there, and that is the sort of the subtle aspect of that person who was Mary Smith back then in the 1900s, who's super attached to her house and is born as a spirit in that house, identifying that's my house. A number of people, one of the ways they talk about spirits in Buddhist culture, Buddhist tradition, spirits of these beings, mind, consciousness, just like yours. You can be a spirit, a human one life, and be born as a spirit the next. So there's one story, for example, one of our lamas, Geshe Lama Khonchog, a great meditator, spent 30 years up in the caves meditating for years and years, naked, no clothes, no food. They don't need it at that stage. They're able to keep themselves alive, and they live on the essence of the air. They have these pills that Tibetan doctors make called chulen, taking the essence, and they take the essence from the flowers and the minerals, and people who are meditators can live on these for years. They get real skinny, but it keeps them strong because they're quite subtle, and they can survive. But some of them even live on the air. They can sort of, they eat the air, basically. They're able to extract the essence from the air to survive. This is one of them. He was like that. Didn't eat or sleep. Didn't need it. They meditate at their subtle level. They don't need the gross body, you know. Doing all these things, getting realizations, blah, blah, blah. So anyway, one of their characteristics is they're super clear. They can see past and future. They've accessed their subtle mind, which has the capability of clairvoyance. And they've got this totally trained, you know. They're able to see the minds of others, therefore can truly help others in a much deeper way. So anyway, this one time, the local villagers found him in his cave, and he became their lama, and he built monasteries and nunneries and things like this. And then one time he's up in his cave meditating. Excuse me. And he, some of the Tibetan nuns, traipsed up 12 hours, you know. No mobiles in those days. Maybe they wouldn't work up there anyway. So anyway, crying, saying, oh, Annie Tenzin, Annie means the term they use for nun, has gone crazy. Annie Tenzin's gone crazy. He said, oh, it's cool, I'll go down. So anyway, he went down, and he got there real quick because one of these great yogis, they've completely controlled their inner physical energies, therefore they can manipulate the external energies. They can change the weather. They can ride on the air, all these things. There's all these technical explanations of what they can do because of the way we're made, the components of the physical being made up of the four elements. There's all these discussions and explanations. Anyway, he gets down there quickly, and he goes into the room, and there's Annie Tenzin in bed with his very deep voice, you know, kind of freaking out. So he can see, this is how they talk, that she's possessed by a spirit. That's how they talk. We hear so many people hearing voices. In many cases, the Buddha would say, this view would say they are hearing voices. They're possessed by another mind, a being, a spirit. Because one of the characteristics of a spirit realm is this unbelievable, over-the-top, trillions times more intense grasping and attachment than we could ever imagine. They're completely driven by this frantic grasping and attachment, and that's what causes them to get a spirit type of birth. Their mind is conjoined with air energy. Our mind's conjoined with a bag of bones, so is the rat's. Theirs is conjoined with air energy. And they're driven from pillar to post by this terrible grasping and terrible suffering. Trillions of them, Buddha says. Anyway, this nun, Geshe goes to him, Genla, they call him, Genla, it's a polite term for teacher, you know. And he knows the spirit is there because that nun has got something of his. So that he says, so you say to the spirit, what do you want? And they talk, you know, so he talks to the spirit. And the spirit is, and the guy in the nun, the spirit, thinks like this. The spirit is not like what we call spirit. It's a type of rebirth, okay? A sentient being. So the spirit goes, I want my pink thermos with the white flowers. I want my pink thermos with the white flowers. Sure enough, there it is. And the nuns remembered that this villager who died recently had given this thermos of tea to the nun and she forgot to give it back. Well, the poor villager's resentful and angry and upset about his thermos. He dies with his grasping and attachment. I'm not joking. This is why death is such a powerful time. Grasping is so strong at the time of death. So you've got to die with a peaceful, ungrasping mind. It's the most precious, important thing to help a person do. Because grasping is completely the function of ego. Ego is like this vampire that's frantically grasping. That can only trigger negative karmic seeds. So for him, he got born as a spirit. And then he runs frantically here and there looking, it's like looking for his objects. Sounds like a joke. He wants this ridiculous thermos. Tears. He's crying and saying, I can't find my way. It's so kind of poignant. Geshe-la happens to know who this being is, so they've got to give the object away, which cuts the connection. In this case, because he knew who the spirit was, this previous bloke, they do prayers, and then he helps them leave and hopefully get a decent human birth, you know. So you hear stories like this all the time. This is a Buddhist explanation. So we can see many people hearing voices all the time, going crazy, being driven by beings to do harmful things. We just think they're schizophrenic and insane, give them pills, you know. Can be their own mind sometimes, but often it is beings possessing them, quite literally a spirit. And usually, so if you have, you know, many spirits, one of them is they're very suffering, very intensely grasping and very suffering. And so they'd be very harmful. So you can have a really intense relationship with your partner and hate each other and beat each other up every day. Then one of them dies. Honey, be careful. They're going to possess you next life and make life a torture for you. Because of attachment. That's the trouble. It sounds like a joke. But it's interesting explanation, you've got to admit. So there's so many of these stories, spirits. Many other kinds of spirits, but this is one kind who have a strong connection with other humans due to having been human. Or animals, for example, you know, the same. being born as an animal. Same thing. Spirit. And then there's even the worst suffering. Just like the Christians tell us, just like the Muslims tell us, which you just think is superstition, it's called the hells. Buddhists have the same view, the same observation as beings. The most intense suffering from the most intense harm. So the point again here is not, these are not places where you're sent by God. That's the hugest difference in the explanation of these. These are states of mind with karmic appearances, with movies playing out that are the fruit of our own past actions. So how it actually works is, of course, the hard part. But the more we understand the way mind works, the more we understand that habit, the more we understand these things, which is the Buddhist practice, the teachings and the study that we have to do to try and comprehend it, the more this can make sense, you know. This is Buddha's view. Okay? So the suffering and happiness Buddha's talking about, at the moment he says we're all in this realm of the six realms of the desire realm, being in samsara, caught up in these delusions. And also a way of talking about samsara is being caught up in going from realm to realm to realm, up, sometimes a good one, sometimes a bad one, sometimes a good one, never endingly, until we start doing something about it, you know, until we cut the causes of suffering, until we stop the causes of suffering. So you can talk about happiness and suffering at a relative level in our own life, but we can just expand it to actually the types of rebirths, you know. So relatively speaking, a happy rebirth within samsara, relatively speaking, is said to be a human one, even though it's a garbage dump. Look at the suffering we have. Look at the harm we do to each other. But nevertheless, as a rebirth, with opportunities to change, it's the best one we can, it's about the best we can get. It's a marvelous one to get if you want to work on yourself. If you're a lion or a rat, sorry, you've got all these potentials in your mind, the same potentials, but you can't access them. And forget about being a spirit, forget a hell being. There's so much suffering, you can't think of anything else. So the human one is the best of a bad lot, really. In order to finally cut the causes of suffering. Cut the causes of suffering. And cultivate the causes of happiness. So getting to this sense that Buddha then talks, what is finally actual happiness? What is actual happiness? What is actual real happiness? And this is the point. He talks about in the Four Noble Truths, this is the First Noble Truth, there is suffering. He talks about it at three levels. The first kind, in the bigger picture point of view, is the lower realms. And within a shorter, a smaller picture point of view, our own life, it's when the bad things happen. When the ugly things happen, when the mean things happen, when you meet the object of your aversion and Fred punches you or the boyfriend leaves you or the people are mean to you or you get harmed, you have a car accident, you get sick, when all the bad things happen, we know that's called this obvious level of suffering within our life. The bigger picture, like I said, is the lower realms. Then the second kind of suffering is very depressing for us from the point of view of this life because it's what we call happiness. This is what we're talking about here. It's what we call happiness, getting the good things. Getting the good things. But for the Buddha, this is a subtler level of suffering. He calls it the suffering of change. Because we know you get the cake, you get Fred, and we know it doesn't last. It's called the suffering of change. So it seems kind of boring. We kind of know it doesn't last. We know that you get too full from a cake and if you kept eating, you'd vomit. We know that the moment of happiness is quite short, and if you keep eating, eventually it becomes disgusting. We know that, but we just assume that's the only happiness there is. Even though we're grasping for permanent happiness, finally I've found happiness, we will say. So we have all these other mistakes we make. We meet that boyfriend and we think we've now finally found happiness. What we mean is we think it will last forever. We believe it will last forever because we're frantic for it to last forever. But it's a mistake again, and we will observe in everybody else's life in the universe, it doesn't last. It changes. So then we'll hear that. We kind of know that, but we don't know any other option. We have no idea. We don't know any other option. We don't know how else to get... We've never heard of a happiness. We don't believe such a thing exists that's happiness, hear the words, that doesn't change into suffering. Okay, so what's Buddha's view? Finally, he is stating, he says, this is the point of all these practices, is to eventually cultivate the causes of happiness that isn't the polluted happiness, which is the product of attachment, but is happiness that is valid, that is, and that doesn't change into suffering. We don't posit such a thing. And it sounds kind of abstract. And then we'll hear another name for that called nirvana. We go, oh, yeah, that's right, that's heaven. Thanks a lot. I want it now, please. You know, I don't want heaven, I want that. So what does he mean by nirvana? Well, it actually means cessation. The word is cessation. And it means you've finally accomplished, and this is the third noble truth. The first one is there is suffering. The second one is there are causes, and we've gone into those, karma and delusions, just touched upon them. The third one is that there is the possibility to be free of it. There is a state called cessation of suffering and its causes, nirvana. And then fourth is how to do it, the methods. So what does it mean, nirvana? We see, we can't imagine this because we don't know anything like this in our world, in our psychology. So what does he mean by this? Well, I'll just tell you the words, and we have to do our best to understand it. You have accomplished in your mind the cessation of suffering, that is nirvana, which is happiness that won't ever change into suffering, when you have cut all the causes of suffering. So what are the causes of suffering? There are two main ones: negative karma in the past, driven by the intention, the motivation, and the hand and the speech doing the action, that then sows the seed in the mind, that ripens as that suffering. When you, the karma and the delusion, there's two: karma motivated by the delusion, the action of the mind and the body motivated by the delusion. That's what makes a negative action. That's what, so if you subsume both of those down to one, the delusion. The main cause of suffering is the negative states of mind. The main cause of suffering is the negative states of mind. And those, as we know, there's this hierarchy of them. There's the grossest, the root delusion, the mother of them all, the one that's the cause finally of all the others, of all suffering, of all rebirths. The root delusion called ego grasping, or known simply as ignorance, but known in Tibetan, mat rigpa, unawareness. It's this primordial, deeply, primordially instinctive grasping at the wrong sense of self. We'll go into this. Basically call it that for now. It's a completely mistaken sense of self that is super fierce, super intense like a vampire, super panic stricken, super fearful, that causes frantic attachment to get what that I wants every second, that causes rage and distress and depression and fear and upset and anger when it doesn't get what it wants, that then causes jealousy and all the other rubbish, that causes us to do bad things to sentient beings, that keeps perpetuating our rebirth after rebirth after rebirth, our suffering, excuse me, after suffering after suffering. So, you have accomplished the cessation of suffering and its causes, nirvana, which is happiness that doesn't change into suffering. When you have uprooted finally this root delusion by realizing emptiness, which we'll talk about, and then obviously if you've uprooted the root delusion, you've uprooted all the branches, attachment of anger and all the other rubbish, therefore you can't harm sentient beings. So you've uprooted all karmic negative imprints and all the negative tendencies in the mind. When they are finally removed from the mind, when they have finally been fundamentally, utterly, completely, and totally, and irreversibly removed from the mind, which Buddha says is possible, and the entirety of Buddha's path is leading us to this, that is, you have now achieved happiness, which doesn't change into suffering. This is what Buddha says. This is Buddha's view. Then you add an extra piece to that. If you want, then the more, because the more you do this work, this is all the first and second stages of practice. This is junior school and high school, the first and second scopes of the Lam Rim. If you keep moving, you're going to see everybody else is in the same boat, and you find it unbearable. So then you cultivate the compassion wing, which means once you've even finished suffering, you don't need to be reborn again in this garbage dumps, because you have such compassion, you will happily be reborn, not just as a human, but because you've gone beyond ego, beyond nonsense, beyond delusions, beyond suffering, and have such power and courage and love and compassion for others, you're going to be born as hell beings, as dogs, you name it, wherever you choose, for the sake of sentient beings. Then you're a Buddha. So any questions before lunch? Yes, sweetheart, down the end there. Time goes so quickly, doesn't it? No time to talk about anything.
I'll make this quick.
Where are you going?
I'm sure everybody's hungry.
No, go on, it's fine, we've got time.
But anyway, you're talking about the realms, and I certainly understand when I die, karmic seed will ripen.
Okay.
when an animal dies,
yep.
Karmic
same,
seed
yes.
will lighten.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, spiritual realm, hell realm. How does a mind exit?
Well, animals as well. The spirit realm. It's very difficult. But let's say that example of the spirit, the being who was the bloke down the road, the human villager who lent the thermos to the nun, who died with distress and upset and annoyance and attachment, even to his thermos. That threw him into the life of being a spirit. But all his other karmic seeds were there. He even recognized Genla. He knew it was Genla. He could see, but he was born in the, he said, this spirit is possessing this nun. So then, because Genla had a karmic connection with him, and knew who he was, and could help him, then he helped that spirit stop being a spirit and get a human birth. How fortunate. Because he had the karmic connection with Genla, so it was able to happen. So, it's very possible that can happen. But it's not, it's rare if you haven't got a connection. You can't be helped. An animal, the same. You could have a little dog. And you're kind to that dog. It's seeing you every day as a human. It's really attached to you as a human, right? It's all wags its little tail, all cute, and do anything you want it to do. But you're kind to it. You play it mantras. You put imprints into its mind, very strong karmic imprints of the Buddha in its mind, right? And then you help it die peacefully. That grasping, when we do look at the 12 links of dependent arising, I don't know if you've learned that, you know, you, at the time of death, craving and grasping, the number 8 and number 9 links, play a very powerful role. And until you're a highly evolved being, you're going to have this very intense grasping at the time of death. So there's that animal. It's got also bucket loads of karmic imprints in its little bank vault of virtue from the past. But what triggers one of those to ripen so it can get a human birth is you being kind to it. You make it peaceful. It hears the Buddha's teachings. And it's grasping at you because it's so attached to you. It causes, because it's attached to being a human, it causes a virtuous human seed to ripen and next life can get human. It's difficult, but it's possible. We've been animals countless times and spirits and hell beings. So it's not, that's why the ones we can see, the spirits, but there's all these other practices that the lamas do. I know Lama Zopa spends his day and night doing practices for the spirits and practices for this one. He never stops, you know. The ocean, all the creatures, he brings things and puts mantras into the sea to bless the beings. All the time there are things we can do for the other kinds of beings to help trigger their own virtuous karmic seeds that are there.
So does Buddha say a mind could exit the hell realm? Or
that's what I'm saying, darling. That's what I'm saying. Yeah, that's my point. I didn't make it clearly enough. I didn't say it clearly. I'm so sorry. We have been hell beings countless times ourselves. We have been animals countless times. We've been spirits countless times. So here we are human. So it deduces we can. We've been all these realms, Buddha says, countless lives.
Okay.
It's not easy. It's hard to see. And it is hard once we've got those suffering. It's even hard as an animal. I mean, it's the little dog who is living with a human. That's like the God realm of animals, really, in a way. You understand? Because they're around humans. But that creature, that ant, those little creatures, those fish in the bottom of the ocean, what chance do they have? They've got the karmic seeds of being human. Of even enlightenment are there, but they can't access them. But eventually, it'll happen. The karma's there, and one day it'll ripen, you know. Do you see?
I do.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. Someone else? Down the end there, back at the bottom, at the end, at the end. Oh, okay. Yes, we do.
Just a quick question. I keep thinking about population growth.
Yeah, that's right.
And my mind is...
More and more humans, yeah.
More and more...
That's right.
Everything. So how can everybody have come from something before?
What do you mean, how?
Like, if I existed before my parents got together...
That's right.
There aren't enough going to go around and...
Not enough what?
There aren't enough previous... lives.
You're assuming humans, though.
Even
but you're assuming humans.
Aren't all realms increasing in population? I mean,
they can't increase. There can't be new sentient beings starting, and there can never be sentient beings going out of existence. There's only the same number.
Really? See,
yeah.
I didn't know
well,
that.
If you think about the beginningless idea, you're implying there are new consciousnesses beginning. What would cause them to begin?
That's what was my question.
I understand. Well, that's the answer to you is you can't have a new one beginning because that means that consciousness will have a first moment. You can't have a thing having a first moment that doesn't have a previous cause. There can't be such a thing.
There aren't more sentient beings than there were 1,000 years ago?
No. Can't be. Ever. There are more humans. Which means some are creating virtue and we're getting human birth, but the unfortunate catch there is the quality of the human birth is going downhill fast. So it's a cheaper and easier thing to get. That's why there are more of them. It's degenerate times, they say.
Thank you.
The end there. At the end, sweetheart.
My question is about karma, and I want to know if karma leaves any space for a good killing.
Okay.
Like killing mosquitoes or killing roaches or killing something that's going to harm you. What is wrong with that?
So we have to unpack the logic, unpack what's going on in the mind. Okay? Because the bottom line about karma, it's not an externally defined event. It's an event defined by what goes on in the mind of a person. So we analyze in general, would you agree in general, in the world, that the action of killing something is motivated usually either by attachment to, if you want to eat its flesh, or aversion for it. In general, would you agree with that?
Absolutely.
Okay, so if we look at the character of aversion, which is how dare that is coming basically on my attachment, not getting what it wants. It's a strong state of mind. It's anger. It has dislike and aversion to that thing because it's disturbing my peace. So I'm going to destroy that. Don't you think that's the cause of all suffering on this earth? Look at the earth. How can that be a good quality? In general, how can that be a good quality? How can that do nothing other than pollute the person's mind who has it? How could it not pollute the mind of the person who has it? It's an impossibility, isn't it? Well, that's the answer. So when we first get the first point of karma, Buddha's not going on about compassion. That comes way later. He says what we've got to understand is that every microsecond of what my mind is doing is programming me with those qualities. That's the fundamental point. And then when we start to understand this one, all it means is every microsecond of what I think and do and say, because let's face it, my speech and my body are just the servants of my mind doing my wishes. Every microsecond of what we think and do and say necessarily programs me into the person I become. So when we understand the states of mind, aversion, attachment, the I-based, totally primordially ego-based states of mind that only exist to do my wishes, and if other people disturb my peace, then I'm going to harm them. That's how we are. That's how the sentient beings, that's how the world is. Look at the animal realm. Look at humans. We never stop harming each other, driven by attachment and aversion. So Buddha says this is the nightmare of samsara. So we start to realize that I produce that in myself every microsecond, that I would only want to first to stop harming others and then to stop even the states of mind so that I can become liberated from suffering and then I help others. So from this, everything is extrapolated. We have to take responsibility. So, of course, you're going to think of a million conditions in which you can think, well, maybe it's not so bad. But there are a million different variations. But the bottom line is, it's not judgment, it's not reward, there's not a question, am I allowed to kill this ant, mummy? Oh, yes, you can get away with it. That's how we think of morality. It's we who have to be responsible. We can use examples, you know. I've got to look inside and then know that I don't want an aversion state of mind. I don't want anger. I don't want jealousy. I don't want depression. I don't want attachment. I'm sick of this disgusting poison because it makes me insane and it caused me to harm others and that produces my future suffering like a nightmare. I am sick of this. I'm going to get the hell out of it. That's renunciation and that's a sense of accountability based upon my own mind and my own actions. So I will do everything in my life then for that reason, this is the point, to avoid harming others and to avoid polluting myself, which is the first reason to not harm others. So it takes time to think about it.
So as a Buddhist, if your house is with termites, you should just move out and leave it to them.
A person who's a really genuine Buddhist who really has compassion as well for what's renunciation, they would not touch those lights. They would move out of the house. They'd sell the house and go. I would say that, yes. A person who's really sincere. You hear the great stories of the bodhisattvas. Lama Zopa, for example, would allow the fleas to live in his socks. Would feed his body at night while he's meditating, have his shirt over his head. His attendant will walk in and give him a cup of tea at 3 a.m. and he's meditating and his body is naked and all the mosquitoes are having their feast. There's one old yogi in Dharamsala who had some creature up in his nose that's eating away at his bone. I mean, these are mad stories. They would never harm a single sentient being. That's when you've got great compassion. So with the top, I agree with you. But, you know, when you really understand that everything we think and do and say is producing me, is an enormous... It's sort of like we understand this when it comes to food. There's no way in the universe now with our skillful, intelligent understanding about nutrition, every packet's like a scientific document on it, you know? There's no way in the universe if we knew there's a moment of peanut in something, it'll cause me sickness. We would never touch it even if we're starving. Because we understand the simple concept that there are consequences of whatever I do that I put in my mouth. Well, the same logic here, karma. There are consequences to me. And it's not punishment. It's not reward. It's a question of being accountable and understanding the mind and how it functions and how I produce my own reality. And first, not wanting suffering. Being sick of suffering. Being fed up to the teeth with suffering. But taking responsibility, realizing I'm the cause of it. It's very kind of grown up already, you know, at this point. This is junior school.
Thank you.
So I was wondering, say I've got a piece of cake and I'm attached to it and I go ahead and eat it. Is it kind of dangerous or is there consequences of then enjoying that cake?
Enjoyment? Okay, no time to talk now. We'll talk after lunch. It's perfect. This is the point. There are a whole... What's your name again? I forget.
Tim.
Tim. Okay. There's a whole bunch of things happening in that moment of you experiencing the cake. There's attachment to it, which is the craving, desperate, believing it'll make me happy, and that's overriding everything else. It runs the show. There's also the capacity to enjoy pleasure, which is called happiness, remember? And there's no doubt when you put the cake in the mouth, it triggers a pleasant feeling, doesn't it? A pleasant feeling is perfectly fine. It's called happiness. It's called happiness, right? But the attachment, which is the vampire, the craving, the junkie, that believes, my God, this is so divine, I'm going to shove it in and then have another mouthful, another until you want to vomit, that pollutes any happiness we have. So the point is, and this is what we do all about after lunch, that is called happiness. A pleasant feeling is happiness, and there's nothing wrong with a pleasant feeling. The more the better, please. But our method of getting it, Buddha says, is what drags it down to hell. Our method of getting it is the junkie craving, and that pollutes it. So we have to learn the skill, because we usually have to eat. We can't live on the air, most of us, so we have to eat, live on chocolate cakes and the big lumpy things, you know. So we're risking our attachment every time, but we have to learn about our mind, and that's why we have to have discipline. It's obvious, isn't it? And learn to see your mind more and more precisely, and I'd be able to identify the pleasant feeling from the attachment, because they're actually quite separate. Virtually impossible to see right now, because they seem so linked, you know.
So kind of if you can walk away, then if you can walk away from it after it's done and... You know, be okay with that, then that's kind of
okay
part of
with
it.
What?
The fact that the cake is gone and that you shouldn't keep eating more and more and more.
Yeah, of course, all that's part of the practice, training our mind to see it differently, you know. Of course, it's all part of the practice. And so we know ourselves, some objects are very strong for us, aren't they? Of the typical examples of heroin and alcohol, you know, or cigarettes that are very easily addictive. We can see with those, there's no choice. Best just to give them up. When it's really strong attachment. So then it's really hard, quite difficult. So some objects we can be more reasonable with. We have to just be skillful, you know. Do you understand? We have to know our own minds. Yeah. Someone else? Yeah, go.
Hi. I have a confusion.
Mm.
So did you say earlier that there's a fixed number of sentient beings that come from beginningless time?
That's right. Buddha says that, yeah.
Yeah. If that's the case, then how could they have come into being? There have to be causes and conditions for them to come into being.
No. No one can come into being. We're always into being.
Well, sentient being.
We're always beings. We're always sentient beings.
So where did they come from?
Beginningless time. This is what's your name?
Dan.
This is an interesting point, Dan. We all have the same question, and it's always so puzzling to us to hear that something didn't have a first moment. We just assume so absolutely there has to be a first moment of everything, an absolute first moment, a first moment before which there was nothing. That's why we have the Big Bang theories. We always believe there has to be a moment before which there was nothing. We have this view deep in our bones. And all Buddha is saying is it's completely irrational and meaningless and nonsense. It's not a possibility. If we posit the logic of cause and effect. So we look in the world in general. Do you agree that cause and effect seems to play out? If you do this, this, and this, you're probably going to get that. And we learn those causes and conditions, and that's why we get brilliant buildings and lovely computers, and we can do it every time. We can replicate those laws, can't we? And we get it down. We understand the laws of cause and effect. So Buddha's talking about the laws of cause and effect of the mind, and of happiness and suffering, and of anger and jealousy, and that's his model of cause and effect about it in terms of happiness and suffering, not cakes and computers. Do you understand? So, in general, the law of cause and effect exists, which means, and everything exists according to it, which means if there is this thing at this moment, a cup at this moment, then if we could track it back perfectly, millisecond by millisecond, you know that if you keep going, you'd get back to the first moment of this universe. Do you agree with that?
Mm-hmm.
You'd have to, wouldn't you? So then you've got to ask the question, well, what about before that? Wouldn't you have to ask that?
No.
So if there is such a thing as the first moment of the universe, which there is, because there was a first moment of a cup, there was a first moment of Dan, the coming together of various... Listen to the words. The first moment of Dan, would you agree, is the coming together of various conditions. Egg, sperm, and your consciousness, Buddha would say. And they all come together. That's the first second of Dan. Can you agree with that? Mm-hmm. There's the first second at some point this cup began to be a cup, when the handle got put on, or the base, you understand, when it came out of the oven ready. That's the first second of this cup. But necessarily, a thing that is the first moment of a cup comes together from other things putting together to make it a cup. Do you agree with that? So then those things had a cause, didn't they?
But
those things had a cause. Keep going. Didn't they?
Yes,
then those things had a cause. And you get back to the first second of the universe, and so whatever the first second of the universe is consisting of, and Buddha would say it's the four elements, that has to come from previous of the same, of another universe. And then that one has to come from a previous universe. You can never have a first moment, because that implies something comes into being that didn't depend upon causes and conditions coming together. And that is literally, logically, an impossibility if you posit cause and effect. So you can't have a first moment of a mind, because a mind, the causes and conditions of a mind, is simply the previous moment of that mind. Like the chicken and the egg. Dan's consciousness is a river of mental moments. We can track your mind back to the first second of conception in your mummy's womb in an unbroken chain of mental moments. Can we not do that if you had perfect memory?
Yes.
You understand? So then we have to ask, where did Dan come from? Because the Dan is the coming together of egg, sperm and mind. Egg went to mummy's body. Sperm went to daddy's, and mind went to a previous moment of itself.
Not necessarily.
Buddha's view. I'm discussing Buddha's view here, Dan.
But even with that view...
Consciousness is not physical.
Consciousness is
a habit of love and compassion and kindness and goodness, which comes from having practice. Now listen, this is the point, and then you can say your point. What Dan's mind is its components, which is love, compassion, kindness, anger, lust, jealousy, whatever you are, baby, you know, join the club. They're all these tendencies that are personal, that in that consciousness, programmed into that consciousness, by that consciousness. That's the Buddha's view of mind. So we get back to the first second, the conception of Dan, egg and sperm are in mummy and daddy's bodies, minding their own business. Consciousness is the previous second is all those tendencies, going back to a previous second of those tendencies, and then the previous before that, and that, and that. And you keep tracking, and you can't find a first moment of that continuity of mental moments, that continuity of tendencies.
That, to me, sounds like faith.
It's logic.
Well, for example...
It's not faith. It's logic.
It's not necessarily... Well,
which
for example,
is the bit that's not logical? Okay, which one? Which
if
bit?
I take flour, eggs, butter, sugar,
that's
and put
right.
it together...
You get a cake. That's
I
right.
get a cake.
Good, then.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
The cake did not exist, and it's more than the aggregate of...
That's right. Precisely. All this, then.
So why isn't it the same possibility that you take egg and sperm and put it together, and it becomes me?
This is the whole point.
It doesn't require a mind to be applied to
it. I know. That's the point that we have to look at, which is the Westerners are trying to do. Trying to see that the body, the person, is only the egg and sperm. That's what we've been saying for thousands of years since they stopped being Catholics. That's what they're positing. That's the whole Western view. And you have to look at the contradictions of this.
Well, that's not what I said.
But that is what you're saying. You said it's only egg and sperm.
No, that's not what I said.
What did you say?
I said the conditions of those coming together creates...
A person. I'm just saying that. I repeat. That's what the materialist model is saying. That Dan is only the egg and sperm. I beg your pardon? They're not saying that. What is the West saying? What am I mistaken?
For example,
is the bit that's wrong, what I just said?
For example, when I turn on and use my computer, or you use your iPad.
No, keep saying the same thing, please.
It's the same thing.
No, I want you to go back to the one of egg and sperm. What are you suggesting isn't what I just said? You said, I'm saying...
It's a gestalt.
I don't know what gestalt means. Please, just a minute. Dan. You just said, I'm saying a person for the Buddha is called egg, sperm, and consciousness coming together. You're suggesting egg and sperm will produce the consciousness. Is that what you're suggesting? That's what I'm saying. The materialist view is saying.
Yeah, and I'm not saying that.
Oh, what are you saying then?
A gestalt is
I don't know what it means. What's a gestalt? Define it.
Greater than the sum of the parts.
That's a meaningless statement. We're just talking about emptiness, baby. That is a discussion when we talk about emptiness. But we're talking practical issue here. The components of something.
It is practical.
The components of something.
So what evidence would there be that there would be a mind
when the sperm and egg come together that would
what
come
evidence?
From somewhere else?
People's experience of it.
Whose experience?
Countless beings who become enlightened. Countless meditators. Countless people who have had that experience. Who the reports are all there, and it's in Buddha's teaching, starting with Mr. Buddha. That's what Buddhism is. Buddhism, listen, Dan, listen. You don't have to believe a single word of this. This is all your hypothesis, but you've got to look into it first. And you've got to, so first of all, the main point to go back to, this is coming from a bloke called Buddha who lived 2,500 years ago or so in India. The logic was he was a bloke like you, regular guy, assuming you're a real, maybe you're a Buddha, I don't know, but let's pretend you're a regular person like me with delusions and ordinary and, you know, whatever. That's an ordinary sentient being with the Buddha saying, with ego and attachment and anger and all the rest. He was one of them. Then he, from his own work, came to these, every word you're hearing in this room is coming back from the Buddha, not from his speculation, he didn't create it, but from his experience. So it's coming out of his own experience. He's presenting you his experience, like Einstein presents you his experience of relativity. So Buddha's presenting his experience. So the first point is to take that as your hypothesis. First point. And then for me, well, what I'm trying to do, taking it as my hypothesis, is understand his position intellectually first. I can't leap to an experience of it. I can't tell you I've had a direct experience of past lives yet, but I'm looking at the logic of it, what it is, if it were this, and if it were that, and if it were this, and if it isn't that. That's all I'm doing, and that has to be the first step in everything you use, whether it's called learning to be an acupuncturist, or a pianist, or a computer scientist. You take the theories first, look into them, understand them properly, understand them intellectually, and then they have to be coherent intellectually, and then slowly you have the experience of it. That's all I can say. That's all we're doing here is discussing the theories and just seeing how even intellectually they can be coherent.
Thank you.
Okay. Because Buddha might be wrong, Dan.
Yeah.
Of course he might, and I'm prepared for that. And as the Dalai Lama says, if you follow what he says, all his methodology, and you do the right recipes and you don't get the result, but he is wrong, you've proved it, then you must reject him. So that means the onus really is on us. Yeah. This is the approach, you know.
Yeah.
Let's have lunch. Keep your questions. The point... No, keep your questions. Oh, yeah. So the point is for lunch, how long are we going to have? Just an hour?
Let's come back at 1:30,
so an hour. Okay. So then you can do what you like, but I'd like it to be part of the day, which means you have your lunch and you go blah, blah. You can talk about the politicians and the weather if you like, but I'd rather you leave that till later and talk about this stuff instead. So it makes it part of the course. So it really helps. If you feel like it. If you don't, then be silent, please. So the practice is you make it part of the course. You can be normal and talk about each other and say, hello, how are you? You know, it's okay. Or don't just rabbit on, in other words. Keep it focused or be quiet and go think about it. Either one of those options I'd like you to do. But in the end, you do what you like, of course, because you're the boss. I'm not. In spite of appearances, you're the boss. And I'll see you in about hour and a quarter, hour and 20 or something. And please enjoy. But think of lunch differently. Let's think of lunch differently. Okay. Everything's to try and think about it differently. So normally we see lunch as an object of attachment or aversion, whichever. So we think of it now instead of that as an object of compassion, all the people who've made it and cooked it and died for it and shipped it and cut it and all that rest. We think that's good, I'm going to eat to be fat and healthy so I can be useful to sentient beings. That's enough even, just that, okay? I'll see you soon.